And ladies and gentlemen, he's one of the all-time greats, my buddy, Mr. John Wayne.
You're listening to the John Wayne Gritcast with me, Ethan Wayne.
The hell I was.
We're talking all about the life and legacy of my father.
John Wayne.
Mr. John Wayne.
John Wayne is the United States of America.
Slap some bacon on a biscuit and let's go.
Today we're lucky enough to sit down with Travis Tritt, a country music legend, an actor, a family man, and a patriot. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did.
Well, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you as well.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, like I always feel bad when I go to, like if I go to your show and then I get a chance to say hello, you know, it's tough because I know you're working, you got 1,000 things to do. So it's not always easy to sit down and talk to somebody, but I appreciate you coming on the show.
Truly my pleasure.
Obviously we're doing this because, you know, we want to talk to people about John Wayne and see if and what he meant to them and if it had any effect on their life or their decision-making process or any of the stuff that they do. And so I guess we could kick it off by just, I know you're a fan of John Wayne's.
Absolutely.
And when you were in town playing a concert, we got connected and you heard about our archive and expressed an interest in wanting to come over and see it. And that was exciting for us to get you in there to see, you know, all his personal effects that are now in a museum in Fort Worth, which I think you've also seen.
I've also been there. Yes.
So
pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. I grew up obviously, on John Wayne. Like so many of my contemporaries, my dad, one of his favorite things to do was if there was a really good movie playing, he liked to go to the drive-in. And so a lot of the first times that I ever saw John Wayne movies was at the drive-in with my dad. My dad was a huge John Wayne fan. I mean, everybody in my family loved him. But to me, he always represented not just a great movie star, and his movies were all wonderful, but he also represented Americana. And that was extremely important in my family because, you know, we all had very humble beginnings, humble backgrounds. We looked for people in entertainment that we felt represented us as middle-class working people. And John Wayne, probably more than anybody, represented that to me and my family and practically everybody that I knew at that particular time. Of course, we're talking about back in the mid to late 60s, early 70s. So those were times when, you know, I was just a kid and just trying to sort of find out what I liked and what I represented and what I looked for in people that I considered to be quote unquote heroes of mine. And John Wayne fit the bill perfectly for all of that because he represented Americana. He represented hardworking people, which was the type of people that we were and the type of people that we grew up around. Everybody that I knew was blue collar, just everyday, ordinary. You know, they worked with their hands, and they represented what I felt was the bedrock of American society. And John Wayne really was kind of like our spokesman for so many of us, and loved his movies, loved what he stood for, loved the fact that he loved this country and the people in it. He loved the freedoms that we all enjoy in this country. Mm-hmm. And that represented exactly the way that I felt, my family felt. So he was just a natural hero for us.
Wow. That was, That was great. Think we can end it right there. I don't think we can articulate it any better than that. You know, it's funny. I feel the same way. And yeah. He was my dad. I came along late in his life, but I never, as a little boy, I never thought of my dad as a megastar who made a lot of money and lived almost like a jet set lifestyle. I always felt that we were more blue collar. Work was work. It was very important. It was the center of our universe, going to make a film. You know, as a little boy, I felt that from him. And he never changed. Like that, that was important to him. And all the messages that he gave in the films, in those great lines that he delivered, you know, those pearls of wisdom, the little life advice.
Absolutely.
They're incredible. But when I listen to your songs, especially your new song, Set in Stone.
Yes.
You deliver the same type of information in a different entertainment format, but it's still there. And I was listening and, first I was going to say, is Jerry Reed an influence?
Big influence. Okay. Big influence. Absolutely.
So I listened to Stand Your Ground and, I got a flash of Jerry Reed, like maybe nod your hat to him or something. I don't know.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
A song like Ghost Town Nation, you know, you've got pearls of wisdom in there. You've got direction for people. You know, you're telling them to don't buy into the noise. Calm down.
Yes.
You know, we're America. We're a self-reliant people. We're going to be okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And you know that, I think that, And it's very perceptive for you to read that in, because that is exactly who my music has been targeted for. The same people that I think a lot of your dad's movies were targeted for, that particular audience, that middle class, a hardworking blue collar audience, I think is the same audience that a lot of my music, or most of my music, is targeted for as well, because it's what I know. It's what I understand. I've made a living out of putting into song things that are real to me and things that I know about and experiences that I've had personally, which might not be the experience of somebody that lives, you know, a different type of lifestyle, but it's for everybody, but it's targeted specifically. My music is targeted specifically toward the people that I understand. And that's the kind of people that I grew up around, which were, as I said before, all those hardworking middle-class Americans, you know, that take pride in accomplishing something. They take pride in raising a family. They take pride in a job well done.
Self-worth. Worth of wealth.
Absolutely, 100%. And so that is because that's the people that I understand, that's the people that I write my music for. And I try to tell in my songs, I try to say things that are so in my life and talk about things that are so in my life. And I've always said since the very beginning that I feel if I can really honestly, objectively step back from my music and take a look at it and really feel moved by it, if I can move myself, I can move other people. I know there's other people out there that feel the same way that I do. And so therefore, anytime I write a song or create an album or whatever, I'm always trying to step back and look objectively and say, does this speak to me? Does this move me in any way? Does this cause me to feel any kind of an emotion, whether it's joy or sadness or pride or discouragement or whatever it may be? And I feel that that's sort of the goal in every single song that I write and every single album that I do, is to try to convey that message across to other people that can receive it and identify with it?
Well, it's it comes across to me, and you know, what was it I was listening to? Ain't no big deal. It's just Armageddon.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That's uniquely American mindset.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
It's a way that we look at things that for a long time, the rest of the world didn't, they weren't that mobile. They weren't that flexible. They weren't that entrepreneurial, whatever the new sure. word is. We've yes. been a people who've been able to adapt and overcome because we're working for the greater good of the individual's family and freedom, mm-hmm. the ability to make our own choices.
Yes.
And,
which is what this country was founded on.
Yeah. And what is, again, you know, slightly under attack. And so your music, mm-hmm. I can tell you that it comes to me and I hear that and I go, yeah, it ain't no big deal. It's just Armageddon. You know what I mean, you can deal with it. We're good. Don't buy into that media thing. And my father talked about it in the late 60s. You know, he was talking about there were problems with the studio moguls, the studio heads who ran things in a certain way and had their own set of issues. But when the money came in, when the bankers started buying the studios for profit,
yes,
then he felt doomed, whether yes. it's the news media, the television, the films. Once the dollar became the god over art or, you know, moral code, mm-hmm. distressing to him.
And yes.
you know, we see the issues that have come up.
I think in
decisions like that.
I think, you know, I've been hearing people talk about nostalgia for a long time. I hear people talk about, I first started really hearing about nostalgia probably about 15 to 17 years ago. And the biggest thing that I heard then was from people that were talking about primarily country music, oddly enough. And a lot of people, I mean, a ton of people on social media or people that would come up to me in a restaurant or on the street, they would say, you know, we like a lot of the new country music that's coming out there, but man, two things. We miss the stories. What happened to the great stories that country music used to tell? Because country music, probably more than any other genre that I can think of, tells some of the greatest stories that are not just stories, but they're stories that are relatable to people. And
with life advice.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And they talked about everything from how you feel about your country, how you feel about your family, how you feel about your job, how you feel about your social status, how you feel about all these different things. And that was primarily the bedrock of country music when I was growing up. And so people have told me in the last 15 to 17 years, man, we just miss those stories, man. Those stories are not there anymore. And in the last 2 years, since 2020, I've been hearing a lot about nostalgia from people in a different way. A ton of people, more than I could count, have contacted me and said, man, wouldn't it just be nice to go back just a short period in time when everybody seemed to get along just a little bit better and there wasn't so much hate and so much division in our country and in our world, and the world seemed to move just a little bit slower not too long ago, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, it seemed like it moved a whole lot slower than what it does now. And of course, cable news networks and all these different things that are available to us now, I mean, the news cycle just, it's gone in a flash, and it moves from one thing to the next. And people, I think there's a lot of people that are nostalgic for a time that all of that stuff didn't exist to the extent that it does now. And they just, you know, they just want to, once again, they want to be left alone. They want to have the opportunity to choose their own path and make their own decisions instead of having somebody else do it for them. They want to be able to make their own decisions the way that this country was founded. And I can't think of anybody that represented that more than John Wayne did.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. But again, as the dollar has become the god,
yes,
we need the clicks, we need the eyes, we need that instant satisfaction. And we see that in our whatever you want to call it, the traditional outlets that we see on TV that are sort of dying a slow death and are scrambling to try to do anything they can to come back, because it seems like maybe the leadership is more focused on that next, making that next quarter, making that next session click, rather than looking 10 years down the road or 20 years down the road. Yeah. And I hope as a country that we realize now that we have to look 100 years down the road and be prepared for that and start working towards it.
I agree.
We can't keep printing money and making these ridiculous decisions that are being made. It's going to tear us apart.
I did a song years ago called "It's All About the Money," and it talks about exactly that thing, you know. And once again, if you want to find out why anything particular is happening a certain way, whether you like it or agree with it or not, all you have to do is follow the money these days, and you can find out why that is happening.
And look, don't get me wrong. I want people to be successful. I want people to make money.
As do but, I.
When COVID hit, not to get off track, but when COVID hit, everybody started working remotely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, two people moved to Nashville, a couple people moved to Texas, like everybody scattered. So we made the decision to sell the office that we were in. And it's been great. Like everybody's working terrific. But for me, it's very odd to get up, my clothes on, and still be at home.
Exactly. It's very strange. I mean, in a lot of ways, like what we're doing right now. I mean, in a situation like before 2020, you know, this would have been an in-person interview. And I'll be honest with you, I miss a lot of those. I think there's just something about being in the same room at the same time, talking to somebody one-on-one, that just cannot be replaced. It is a lot more convenient doing it this way. I mean, I can knock out, you know, whereas before 2020, I would have to make a trip to New York or a trip to Los Angeles, both, and spend two or three days doing nothing but interviews, you know, moving from one place to the next. And this is, it's just like you just said, I can get up in the morning, put my clothes on, come up to my studio here, and I can knock out 20 interviews in a day, you know, just back to back to back to back to back, and never really have to leave the house. So it has its good and bad points, but I miss personally, of course, I grew up around the same time you did, and I miss that one-on-one, you know, interaction.
I miss going to the office and having a coffee with everybody and
exactly
catching up.
Yes, yes.
Catching up. I turned 60 a week ago, something like that. Oh, and, wow. You know, I'm at my house, and so Katie and Stephanie came over, and they brought me breakfast and balloons, and then we had a Zoom. And then all 20 people from the office were on the Zoom. So we got to hang out in the morning because they knew that's what I liked.
Congratulations on your 60th, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good.
I'm right behind you.
You know, you talk about the different way we're doing business now. What about the music industry? My God, you guys went through radical overhaul in the last.
Oh, man. Year. You know, it's. Well, first of all, I mean, the new album that I did, that I released last year, the Set in Stone album that you mentioned earlier, that was the first studio album that I had done in about 14 years. Wow. And that's a long time to be away. I mean, I released several live albums during that 14-year period, but things change a lot. And I had a little bit of fear and trepidation about going into the studio again and releasing a new album after all that time, because things change, and they change rapidly these days, more and more rapidly every day that goes by. So I was a little bit apprehensive, but the one thing that I found is that no matter how things change, one thing stays constant, and that is that people are always interested in hearing credible music, good music, that speaks to their hearts. And no matter what type of situation we go through as a nation, I think the last 2 years has been probably the greatest test that we've ever gone through. And to be able to come out of it on the other side and still, you know, we go out, we were, the music industry, the live touring industry, was probably the first business to be affected by COVID. And we were probably some of the last, not me personally, but some of the last overall to come out of it. Because in March of 2020, I mean, I had just completed a solo acoustic tour in January and February, and we were gearing up to start our band tour, which consisted of about, you know, 95 to 100 dates from March through December. And all of a sudden, man, when as soon as we got home from rehearsals in Nashville and we're getting ready to go out on the road, everything got shut down, and we couldn't tour, we couldn't do anything. And there was a long period there during the early part of the early half of 2020 where we weren't sure when or if we were ever going to be allowed to tour again. And that's scary, you know. Yeah. it's scary to be in that situation. But the music industry has definitely changed an awful lot. But once again, I think the people, the audience, I don't think the audience has changed that much. I think the audience still is looking for something real and something credible. Duke Ellington used to say way back when, he said, there's only two kinds of music in this world. There's good and there's bad. And I think people want to hear good music, and they still want to come out to the live performances. After we went through several months of being shut down, locked down at home, we started seeing in the shows that we were able to do from July of 2020 on, the response was just tremendous, because you can only, it's like, I compare it to keeping animals in a cage. That if you keep an animal in a cage for a long period of time, as soon as you open that cage door, that animal is gonna run crazy for a period of time. Just because they get, call it cabin fever, call it whatever you want, but people have a desire. And in my industry, people have a huge desire and a need to be able to just get out and go to a concert and blow off some steam and forget about all their troubles for a while. That, I think, is, and being in the entertainment industry as long as you have, that is what the entertainment industry is for. It is an opportunity to provide people with a getaway, an escape from their everyday problems, worries, things that they have to deal with on a day in, day out basis. It's an escape mechanism. And live concerts are certainly that. And so we were very relieved and thrilled to see the response come back from all of these audience members that we were playing live concerts for. It was like, yeah, man, they were sitting there waiting. with, you know, like on the edge of their seats, man, we've been waiting for this for so long. Thank you for bringing this back. So it's been a, you know, it was a rough time period, but you know, you have to go through some valleys before you get to the mountaintops.
Yep. Hard times make the good times better. That's for sure.
That's a fact.
Your sound, could you play any guitar and get that sound to come out of the speakers? Or are your, I think I saw your guitars, you sort of had a matched set of Martins.
Mm-hmm.
And in person, they sound amazing. And when you play them, they sound amazing. So do you have to, how much of that just comes straight from the guitar, and how much of that do you create in some other, in tones and things like that?
I'll give you, I'm going to answer that question with a story. I did an album in Los Angeles a few years ago, that last album that I did about 14 years ago. Randy Jackson from American Idol actually produced the album. And I wrote a lot of songs for the album. I did songs that were from some of my friends that were songwriters. But one of the songs that I wanted to cover for that album was a Kenny Wayne Shepherd song called Somehow, Somewhere, Some Way. And as soon as we decided that we were going to record that, I called Kenny Wayne and I said, hey man, I'm recording your song. Would you come over to the studio and play on that particular cut? Because he has a sound that is unlike anybody else's and it's totally recognizable. And he agreed. So he comes over to the studio, and of course, all the other guitar players, I had some of the best session players in the business working on this album. And they've got racks of equipment that are, you know, four times bigger than what you see behind me. And they've got huge cabinets with all these different effects and all these different things. And Kenny Wayne walked in with a Fender Champ amplifier, which is a single speaker amp, tiny, small, carry it with one hand. He had that in one hand, he had his guitar in the other, and in the back of the amp he had one effects pedal. That's it. And so he plugs in and starts playing, and immediately all the other musicians, especially the guitar players that were in the studio, they start looking around and say, man, how are you getting that tone? And they were just standing around him in a circle watching him play. And one of the guys looked at him and said, man, how do you get that tone? And he went like this. He held his hands out. And that's truly, I think, the same thing that applies to me or anybody else. I have people ask me all the time, you know, where do you get that tone from? And a lot of it had to do with the way that I learned to play. I wasn't taught by anybody. I didn't have, you know, I never took music classes or guitar classes or whatever. I learned strictly by ear. I can't read music. I can't read a note of music to this day. And so I learned by sitting down with my guitar at my house in my bedroom. And back in the days when we all had vinyl albums, and I would just listen to songs over and over again and try to replicate it by playing guitar. And that's how I learned how to play. So my style, or my tone, if you will, is a conglomeration of all of the different people that influenced me, from Waylon Jennings to Jerry Reed to, you know, people like Chet Atkins. And then later on, you know, in the Southern rock world, people like Gary Rosington from Lynyrd Skynyrd, or, you know, the Allman Brothers, or Charlie Daniels, or, I mean, there's just, the list goes on and on and on. But all of those different things in some way or another, I just kind of put together and came up with my own style, if you will, of playing guitar. So, and I've worked really hard to try to make that sound better over the years, which is one of the biggest reasons why The Martin guitars that you mentioned are such a big part of that, because that helped to help me to modify and improve my sound and my tone, just because of those, how those guitars sound. But it was something that was just a process. It just took a long period of time. And I think probably the same thing applies to my vocals too, because there are notes of people like Ray Charles, people like Greg Allman. There are notes of George Jones, I think, when I sing. And that's deliberately so, because those people were some of the biggest vocal influences that I had as I was growing up.
When you sing, I feel power. I feel like it sounds like it takes strength to sing. Because you sing and then you'll go and you put, there's a lot of energy that goes into it. I don't know how else to just, I don't know the right term for it.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it's that's where the soul, I think, comes from, you know? And once again, that came from, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, I grew up in church in Georgia, and my grandfather was actually a Pentecostal pastor. And of course, you know, when we sang in church, it was all, what a friend we have in Jesus. And it wasn't until I was in my early teens that I started hearing people like Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and some of these others. And the way they would sing those notes would be, what a friend we have in Jesus. And it just had all those bends and those curls, and man, it made me feel something. It was emotional to me. And I remember at a very early age in my early teens thinking, and maybe even before that, probably before that, I remember thinking, man, that's how I want to sing. I want to sing like that. And I started working with my melodies and kind of bending and, you know, curving. And of course there was nobody better than that at doing that than George Jones. I mean, he bent and curved notes like crazy. And I fell in love with that, because like you said, it makes you feel something, I think, when you hear that. So I tried to basically emulate that type of style in my singing and my playing.
Well, in a parallel with you and John Wayne, or really any entertainment, I love to watch a movie. I love to hear a song, but I want it quiet. Like, I want to experience it. And if I feel like it's not real or sincere, I can't go into it.
Yes.
It keeps me out. And so, you know, if I watch a John Wayne movie, I believe it.
Yes.
And I'm pulled in. If I listen to your music, I believe it. And I'm pulled in and I'm inspired. But if I hear something that I don't think is honest or sincere, it's just like, it's hollow.
You know, and I think the general, most people have a sense of that, and that's, they're looking for something that's genuine. You know, there's a lot of plastic out there, especially in the entertainment industry, in all facets. But
especially in Newport Beach, where I live.
I wouldn't dare, but there's a lot of plastic out there, and I think people, you know, most people can differentiate, even if they can't put their finger on exactly what it is about that particular movie or that particular song or that particular album that moves them, or that particular television show that moves them, but there's something about it that just they can identify with, and they can, their radar is very tuned in to something that's genuine and something that's real and something that comes from the place that's real. And people can tell the difference. And I feel the same way. I have to be drawn in by whatever I'm listening to or whatever I'm watching, or else it's just not worth my time.
Mm, I'm with you there. Yeah. You mentioned Aretha Franklin. What a voice.
Oh, man. I just watched the other night. We watched Respect, my wife and I did. And, man, just incredible.
I can't wait to watch it.
It just incredible. What a incredible voice she had. And, of course, Jennifer Hudson does all the singing in the movie. And, man, her voice is just unbelievable as well. So, yeah, it's worth watching. Trust me.
All right. I'm putting it down. And that just reminded me of something else. You've done a bunch of acting.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy that as much as music? Like, can you go away in your acting role as much as you go away into a song?
I do enjoy it. And I think probably one of the biggest reasons that I do enjoy it is because it takes me out of my comfort zone and puts me in an area that, first of all, I never had visions of being an actor as a kid. All I wanted to do was play and write music. That's all I wanted to do. But of course, as often happens, you start having success in the music industry, and people from Hollywood start calling and saying, hey, we'd like for you to read for this part. We'd like to for you to do this part. And my first introduction to acting, I did a video years ago for a song that I had written called Anymore. It was actually a co-write with one of my dear friends, Jill Colucci in Nashville, and she'd written a bunch of great records. But this particular song, the record label wanted to do a video, and their video concept that they came up with, they wanted me to play the part of a disabled American veteran. And they had a whole storyline written out. It was almost like a mini movie. And that was at a time when mini movies and videos was just not being done by too many people. Mm-hmm. But I had to go in and I had to basically act. I had to cry on camera. I had to do all that kind of stuff. And my manager at the time was also managing, among other people, Kenny Rogers. And Kenny Rogers saw that video, and he had a new television movie that was in the works at the time. It was the first television movie that he was going to do, television Western that he was going to do, that was not part of the Gambler series. Hmm. And it had a role, a co-starring role for a young guy that was in the early 90s. So I was probably, around 30 at the time. And it was the role of basically his sidekick, that he wanted me to play that part. And CBS at the time, which that was the network that the movie was being done for, CBS didn't want me because I didn't have a proven track record of being an actor. And Kenny Rogers really went to bat for me. He went to the network and said, first of all, if he doesn't do it, he said, I'm not going to do it. And he said, second of all, he said, he is a better actor now than I have been on any of the things that I've done, especially in the early stages. So he recognized me and he really went to bat for me, and it gave me an opportunity to do something. And I was nervous as all get out when I did that first movie, because it was a total different world for me. And I've heard stories about other artists like Dolly Parton and other people that basically did the same thing I did. I was so nervous. Not only did I learn my lines, I learned everybody's lines in the whole script. And I knew that the only way that I was going to be able to overcome my nervousness about doing this was to be as prepared as I possibly could be. And so I did. I prepared very, very well. But the thing that I've noticed about doing any of the movie roles or TV roles that I've done over the years is that it takes me so far out of music world and puts me in a totally different place where I'm not even thinking about music. I'm concentrating simply on giving the best acting performance that I can possibly give. And whenever I finish a role, whenever we wrap, it reinvigorates me when I come back to doing the music again. I feel like I've been on vacation, you know, for a while, because I'm more focused on the music again. I'm more energized about doing the music again, because it's kind of like leaving your comfort zone and being so grateful and so relieved. It's just like you go, oh, man, so good to be back here where I'm familiar with the territory, you know? So yeah. I enjoy the acting for that reason and a lot of other reasons as well, but probably that's the biggest thing that I get out of it.
Well, that's fun. And yeah. Then we have a connection. We have a small connection. You were in the Blues Brothers.
Yes.
The second Blues Brothers.
Yes.
But I got my Screen Actors Guild. I was in it, but I was a stuntman on the original Blues Brothers.
Oh, really?
In 80 or 81. Yeah. My father had just passed, and a stunt guy that I knew and was friends with, I'd called him and to see if he was around. He said, no, I'm in Chicago. I'm making a movie. And at the end of our conversation, he goes, how old are you? And I go, I'm 17. And he said, you know, what's going on in school? I said, well, I missed, you know, the last 3 months this year because my dad died in June. And I wasn't doing great in school. It didn't capture my attention or my interest at the time. And he said, would you want to come work for me? And I said, yeah, I would like to come work for you. And it ended up being the Blues Brothers, the original one. So I got to see Aretha Franklin. I got to see those musicians. I'm not even a fully formed human. I'm just a half baked cake. I'm just like pudding with bubbles coming out. But I got to see it, and for some reason it probably kept me from, you know, going down the wrong road. But
sure.
I was captivated by the music. Captivated.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, as seeing both, I mean, the first one was wonderful. The second one, the script wasn't all that great, but man, the music was absolutely fantastic. And I was fortunate because I think I'm the only country music artist that was allowed to be a part of that Blues Brothers 2000 film. And to be on stage at the same time with people like B.B. King and Eric Clapton and you know, Skunk Baxter and just a whole plethora of people that are some of the greatest music artists of all time. Just to be able to share
the experience. I mean, even for you, someone who's at the top of the game in the music business for decades, you're affected by being around those other people.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. Without a doubt, because these are heroes of mine. You know, I grew up listening to their music, and
did they let you get away with being straight country, or did they knock you over into Southern rock a little bit?
No, actually, I was able to. I've always had a blues influence, a country influence, a bluegrass influence, a gospel influence. So they basically allowed me to just do what I do, which is show off that blues side or that rhythm and blues side for that particular movie. And you know, the songs, they were all songs that I was very familiar with and knew before we even started, you know, rolling film. But it was just such a great experience. And, you know, just to be around people like that are, you know, Stevie Winwood and Dr. John and all these great, great players, all on stage at the same time, and Lou Rawls and Isaac Hayes. And, you know, I mean, we're all on stage together at the same time. And it was truly, it was just a magic moment, man. And one of the things that I'm, one of the experiences that I'm probably the most grateful for in my entire career.
Being there with those guys.
Absolutely.
And that movie is the vehicle that brought everybody together.
That's it.
It's incredible. I get goosebumps thinking about it.
Look, and that, me
that's,
too.
That's an amazing group of people.
It is a great group of people. Unbelievably. And, you know, I've always really considered myself extremely fortunate to be in a position to meet and get to know and actually work with so many of these people that were my heroes all through my childhood. People that I never, if you'd have come to a 6-year-old or an 8-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 15-year-old or an 18-year-old me and said, you're going to get a chance to not only meet these people, but you're going to get a chance to record with them. You're going to get a chance to work on stage with them. You're going to get a chance to do movies with some of these people. I would have told you were crazy. You know, you're nuts. But I've always considered myself extremely fortunate and extremely blessed to be able to have had some of the experiences that I've had, you know, over, you know, the last 40 years. And it never ceases to amaze me. I'm just blown away by it because I'm the last guy on the planet that would have thought this is going to happen to me at some point when I was just a kid.
Well, it's a great experience, and it's fun to hear about it. I can't even imagine Stevie Winwood, Eric Clapton, you. I mean, these are people that I experienced. You know, John Wayne, there were a lot of fans coming towards my father, so I experienced that. But I'm a fan, you know, of other people. And so yeah. I had both sides of that coin. When my father would make a film, he didn't write the film. You know, he mm-hmm. went, picked a script. I'm sure he edited. He had a lot of input in how it was done. But there were people who wrote really well for John Wayne.
Oh, yeah.
And so in the music industry, do you experience similar things where there are just certain people that you can go like, you know, it's Brent Cobb or it's Channing Wilson or
yes.
some of the other guys that I see, like, are they just get it. They get you.
Well, you know, anytime that I go in to co-write with somebody that I've never written with before, it's always a you know, kind of there's a 50-50 shot that it's gonna work. And I have had numerous sessions with songwriters in the past that, you know, both of you are sitting in the same room together for, you know, 5 or 6 hours staring at blank pages, and you walk away with nothing. And of course, those are the ones you never hear about. But that's happened, you know, a ton of times to me over the years. So when you do find somebody that you click with and you have a chemistry between you, those are the people that you tend to want to, okay, I know that one works. I know that I can write great songs with this person. So when the next project comes along, those are the people that you tend to gravitate toward first. You know, before you even think about, you know, doing more co-writes with somebody that you've never written with before, you fall back on what you know, and you fall back on what you know works. So that's, once again, those are you never know until you actually go in and try. And they're not always successful. But
you ever get an idea where you're driving and you go, you know, whatever, oak tree on a hill, and then you call somebody, you're like, I don't know what it is, but it's oak tree on a hill. Go. I'm going to call you later.
Yeah, I have that happen all the time. As a matter of fact, that's one of the biggest reasons. I still live in Georgia, my home state, very close to where I grew up. And that's one of the biggest reasons. When I first got started in the industry, I had a ton of people that said, oh, man, you got to move to Nashville. And then I had a bunch more that said, oh, you got to move to L.A. And I resisted that. I stayed in Georgia. I've never left here. This is my home. But one of the biggest reasons that I stayed here was because of that very thing. I can get in my pickup truck and drive 20 minutes, 30 minutes in any particular direction and go by places that spark a memory from high school or childhood, or I remember when this happened. I remember when that happened. I remember da 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 da. And it comes out in a song. It sparks an idea for creating a song. And I can't tell you how many times that's happened. So that's one of the advantages, I think, of living so close to where you grew up, is that you can drive by. I can drive by my old high school. You know, it's about 35 minutes away from me. I can drive by my old high school and immediately be hit with a bunch of these memories that just jump out, you know. And a lot of those have ended up in songs that I've done over the years.
That's pretty cool. I drive by my high school and I think I've got 1 year left there. I wonder if that'll be in.
Man, I have a recurring nightmare. Because when I was a freshman in high school, my parents divorced and they remarried each other right after I graduated from high school. So I moved around throughout their divorce. I moved from one school district to a totally different one, and then back to the one that I originally started in. And I'll never forget, man, I was a senior in high school and I already had mapped everything out, man. I had a job, afternoon job already mapped out where I was going to go half a day my senior year. And I was going to, spend the second half of the day each day, you know, on my job, making money, you know. And I remember walking down the hallway and my counselor met me in the hallway and he said, hey, Tripp, what's your plans for your senior year? And I told him, I said, yeah, I've got a job lined up. I'm going to be going into half a day of school and going to my job. And he said, wait a minute, come in my office for a minute. And he pulls out my records and he goes, you don't have enough credits to graduate early or take half a day. You've got all these credits that you've got to make up. And I said, whoa. I said, there's got to be a mistake here somewhere. I said, I know for a fact I've completed all of the courses that I was supposed to take. And, he said, I don't know, man. I'm going to have to check into this because according to this, you don't have enough to take off half a day and you might not even be able to have enough credits to be able to graduate this year. And man, I was in a panic and it threw me into such a panic. I'll tell you the end of the story. The end of the story was that in transferring from one school district to another, they had gotten my records screwed up. And I did in fact have enough credits to be able to take off half a day. But that fear still gives me a recurring nightmare. I have a recurring nightmare that I am trapped in high school and cannot get out, cannot graduate to this day. And it wakes me up in a cold sweat anytime I have that nightmare.
That's funny.
And that's where it came from.
Wow. That's incredible.
So I can relate when you say, you know, I still owe some time there. I can relate.
But that's in your head. That's in your brain. That's in your computer. And it's still there. And it has a visceral effect on you to this day.
Yeah. I mean, I'm 1 year younger than you. I just turned 59. And, you know, to think that after all of this time, all of those years, decades, that fear resonated with me so strongly that I still have that nightmare on occasion. It's amazing.
It's crazy.
It is.
Well, it's cool that you stayed in Georgia. Georgia's a beautiful state.
It is. It's a great place. You know, it's a great place to live, and it's a great place to, you know, raise your family. I've got three wonderful children, and my youngest is in the final stages of his senior year right now. As a matter of fact, he's going to graduate in May. So it's a great place to live. And one of the biggest things too, when I was first getting started back in the late 80s, early 90s, in the music industry, Nashville didn't have any of the things that Atlanta or the Metro Atlanta area had back then. I mean, Nashville's got them now, but back in those days, Nashville had no sports teams whatsoever. None. They didn't have a football team. They didn't have a hockey team. They didn't have anything. And Atlanta had all sports. You know, we had the Hawks, the Braves, the Falcons, you know, and the Flames in Atlanta. And great restaurants, Nashville had none then. Nightlife, even though it was Music City, USA, there were very few places back in those days where you could go and hear live music or play live music back in those days. Oddly enough, I know that may sound strange to a lot of people that weren't around then, but it was just totally different than what it is now. So that made it easy for me to kind of resist that call to move to Nashville or anywhere else for that matter.
Well, it's what was it about Nashville then? Was it the Opry that brought people in there and made it the center, or the place where people go, are, you know, play in front, they get visibility there? Was it the Bluebird Cafe or
Music Row, where everybody recorded? If you were in country music, everybody recorded in Nashville on Music Row. That's where all the studios were. That's where all the publishing companies were. That's where all of the label offices were. And a lot of them are still there. But that was just the center of everything. And, of course, the Opry, the Ryman, you know, Auditorium. That was just sort of the center. And plus all
but that's
of
probably
the,
once you've made it in yes, those days.
Yes. Yes. And the other thing about what drew me into Nashville at the very beginning was when I got signed to a record label, early on in, like 87, when I got signed to Warner Brothers, in order to be able to, all the great songwriters, all the great songwriters in country music, especially, all lived in Nashville. All the great studios were in Nashville. All of the great producers were in Nashville. All of the great musicians and players, session players, were all in Nashville. So if you wanted to record country music, you had to go to Nashville. That was the spot. But I found that rather than having to move there, that I made much more of an impression by not living there, because I remember people telling me early on you know, you made the smart move by not moving to Nashville, because, you know, a lot of these people that have moved to Nashville, big stars that, that if I called their name, you'd know them immediately. But we see them on the streets up here every single day. We see them around here all the time. It's no big deal when they show up in a local restaurant or whatever, a bar or a club or whatever it may be. But if you don't live there and they don't see you that often, man, it creates a stir in Nashville when you come into town. I remember in the early days, I remember disc jockeys on radio stations in Nashville would get on the air and say, we've seen it, we've had a Travis Tritt sighting in Nashville. We've had a Travis Tritt sighting. Somebody saw Travis Tritt in town this morning. He must be in town working on a new album or working on something. And it created a buzz, you know. It was kind of a cool thing. So I'm really happy with the choice that I made to stay here and be, you know, around my family, and my mom's still living, and so I'm fortunate that I get a chance to be close to her, and it's just no place else feels like home to me than Georgia does.
I wanted to ask you about you and your kids, but there was one other thing. Oh, I wanted to ask you if you had a favorite studio, you know, as somebody who's not into music, you know, I'm not in that business, but I love it. And I watched the documentaries like Muscle Shoals, or, you know, that recording studio that Fleetwood Mac used in LA, these
yes.
unique places. Are there places that stand out to you where you went, oh my gosh, I had a great experience there?
Yes, without a doubt, RCA Studio A in Nashville. That is where we did a lot of this last album, Set in Stone. But it is iconic. That's where Dolly Parton recorded I Will Always Love You and Jolene in the same session on the same day.
Wow.
Elvis Presley recorded there. Charlie Pride recorded there. Chet Atkins recorded there. Chris Stapleton has done every single album that he's done from that studio. It's just an iconic place. And the ghosts of those wonderful sessions and those wonderful recordings, I think, still live in that building. There's just something. I get the hair on the back of my neck stands up, you know, when I walk in that studio. There's just something about it. It's just, and it hasn't, you know, the structure itself hasn't really changed that much. But Dave Cobb, that's primarily where he records all of his stuff out of right now, and has been for quite a few years. And so it's pretty much, you know, Dave Cobb's studio now. But if you just go back and through, there's a on one of the tables in the studio, at Studio A, there is a big photo album of all of these iconic sessions that have taken place in that recording studio. Everybody from the people that I just mentioned to Waylon and Willie and, you know, just all these different iconic performances. And the first time that I ever recorded in that studio was actually when I recorded with Marty Stewart. He and I did a song together years ago for his album called This One's Gonna Hurt You for a Long, Long Time. And that was where he was recording at the time. And so we used that studio, and we also we shot a video there. And then I came back a few years later and was invited to be a part of an album called Country Rhythm and Blues. And I got to sing in that studio with Patti LaBelle. And she and I sang the old Sam and Dave song, When Something's Wrong with My Baby. Wow. We did that together in that same studio. So yeah, without a doubt, I can say hands down, that is the most incredible studio that I have been in. Not necessarily because of the electronics, or because there's been other places that I've been to that are more, you know, technically wowing, but just for the history, and I'm a big history buff anyway, so, you know, to be in a studio.
The presence, you say you feel it when you go in there. That's
oh yeah. Yeah. The ghosts of those artists and the ghosts of those sessions, I think, still permeate those buildings. That building 100%. And they're still bouncing around in there somewhere. You know
what amazes me? So I hurt myself and I wasn't allowed to do anything physical years ago. And I'm going to take guitar lessons. So I started taking guitar lessons. And, you know, it's a struggle, especially when you're older. You get a lot of sounds that you don't want to get out of your guitar. It's not your friend at first. I'm slowly right. becoming friends with it. But I'm amazed that on a piece of wood this long, with
yes.
six strings, every sound you've ever heard in any song is right there on that board.
It is. It is.
It's just amazing.
Like, it's a wonderful instrument.
I'll guitar, and I'm amazed that it's all in there.
Yeah.
And I get to go try and find it.
Exactly. You know, and that brings to mind one of the things that Willie Nelson has always said, and I found it fascinating, but it's also extremely true. And somebody asked Willie about how he comes up with song ideas. And he said, man, songs are floating around in the air. All you've got to do is just be smart enough to reach up there and grab one. And I thought that was just such a great answer, you know?
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. What an amazing, amazing gift you have to be able to do that on that little piece of wood.
Yeah. It's a very cool instrument.
You were talking about your kids. You got three kids.
Yes.
You're married.
Yes.
And you guys do a lot of family activities together, I think.
Yes, we do.
You hunt, you fish, you enjoy life.
Yes.
Are you guys pretty regular on the hunts?
We haven't been as much in the last few years as we have. I mean, my wife and I, we were able to we've hunted all over the world together. We went to Africa in 2006 and did a plains game hunt there. And, you know, she grew up in a hunting family. I did too. And so our kids, they really all enjoy it as well. So we haven't had a chance to do as near as much of it as I would have liked to in recent years. Simply because of the fact that, one, the kids were in school, and two, I was on the road all the time. But now that when my youngest son graduates in May, that's going to free up a lot of time, not just for hunting, but for vacations and for other things. A lot of things that we didn't have the chance to do and haven't had the chance to do for a very long time. I think we're going to be able to enjoy that more. But we're such a tight-knit family. My kids all still at the moment, all still live at home with us. And I think that's probably going to be changing pretty soon. But I remember my teenage years, and I couldn't wait to get away from my parents, you know, as a teenager, you know, I couldn't get far enough away from them. And our kids are just totally the opposite of that, which I give all the credit for that to my wife, because she was the one that really instilled in our children, because she was home with them all the time. And she really instilled in them a love of family and how important that family bond is. And so our kids, man, we can be at home. My wife can be at home with me, and we're just watching a movie on television, you know, in our den. And the kids will come walking through, and, what are you guys watching? Well, we're watching so-and-so. You mind if we watch with you? You know, and they'll sit down and watch a movie with us, you know, and that's just such I think it's a wonderful thing. It's a fantastic thing. And I don't think you see near enough of it, man, that nuclear family, experience is something that is being eroded away in society so often. And I'm so thankful, so glad that we still have that in our house. And my kids, you know, whenever they can, you know, they will go out, you know, on the road with me. Or my oldest is my daughter, who is 24 now, and my middle son is 23, and they are both pursuing music careers as well as artists. Oh, okay. So they are getting more and more gigs on their own, and they're not able to come out on the road with me that often. But whenever they get a chance, yeah, they're going to be there, and we all just pile on the bus and go together, you know. And it's so much fun. So much fun.
Great for you to be able to have them. I mean, just the fact that they want to be with you that's a gift.
It is. It really is. Because I see so many.
What are their instruments? Are they guitar, piano?
My all three play guitar to some extent. My best guitar player is my middle son, Tristan. He is a really good guitar player. And my youngest, he plays around with guitar, but he's actually a drummer. He likes to play drums. And so, I think once he graduates from high school, I think he wants to come out, on the road and just kind of work as a tech, for our live shows and, you know, just kind of stage tech, help out. Kind of learn that aspect of the business. The one thing about all three of them, which I take a lot of pride in, is the fact that they all have a love for the industry that their father is in. And I'm sure you can relate to that as well. Obviously, being John Wayne's son and being in the industry as long as you have. But there's something about that, you know. It's kind of like, yeah, chip off the old block, carrying on the family tradition, you know. That's a really cool thing.
Yeah, that is. What's your favorite? What do you guys do the most? Do you go? You go to the beach? You go, like? Do you live on property? You guys mess around there?
We've got property. We live on a 75-acre farm, and when I built this place, I built it to encompass all of the things that I enjoy. We cut a bunch of, part of it is wooded, about half of it is wooded, and half of it is in pasture. Mm-hmm. We grow high-grade Bermuda hay for local horse breeders on our farm. So I cut trails into the woods for four-wheelers. I cut trails into the woods for horseback riding. We have about a 3.5-acre, 4-acre lake in front of our house that is stocked with largemouth bass, channel catfish, and bluegill, so that I or any of my family can go out there and go fishing anytime they want to. It's just, you know, we have the horseback riding. We have so many things right here on our property. Tons of wildlife. So it's a great experience, and we never really have to leave the property for that. So I think a lot of the love that my children have for the outdoors and for nature and just kind of not only the love for it, but kind of being a steward of it. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that comes from growing up right here.
It's awesome. Well, Travis, I've taken a lot of your time today, and I really appreciate you talking to us.
Man, it's been such a pleasure, Ethan. I appreciate it so very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and one day I'll knock on your door.
Sounds good.
You're welcome.
You're welcome anytime.
All right. Talk to you soon, my friend.
Thank you, buddy. Bye. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening to the John Wayne Gritcast. Make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. If you like what you heard, give us 5 stars in the Apple Podcast app and follow us on social media at John Wayne Official.
Slap some bacon on a biscuit and let's go.